Welcome to Electric Evolution with Liz Allen. This podcast is about the journey to a more sustainable future in order for us to be able to do our bit to achieve net zero. I'll be discussing a variety of topics with experts in their field in order to educate and increase our knowledge of clean energy, electric vehicles, and the electric vehicle infrastructure. So whether you're an individual wanting to make a difference at home, a small business, or a corporate, this podcast is just for you. On today's episode, I've got Chris Bingham, and he is the CEO of Green Arc Limited. Now, he's actually based in my old hometown of Halifax, which always gets me really excited. Thank you, Chris. Thank you for joining me. It's brilliant to have you on here.
My pleasure. Good morning to you.
So you are also the chairman of Craggs Energy Group and the CEO of LCM Environmental. And we've just been having a chat before we started recording. How many businesses do you actually run?
So in terms of my day-to-day, Green Arc, 80-90% of my focus. I'm also chairman, as you rightly say, of LCM and Craggs Energy. And they're run by some fabulous management teams who are far better than me at running businesses anyway. And if you look at 10 or 15 companies I've got a various interest in, but I learned some time ago that as an entrepreneur, when a business reaches a certain size, the person that was good at getting it started is often the thing that holds it back. So I keep out of the way. So I bring in really talented people to run them for me, and then I go on to the next thing that's exciting and new.
But that's good. Hey, that's the main thing, isn't it? If you recognise these things, if you recognise that, then and you know you've got good people involved, then they'll run with it, and it's been your brainchild. But yeah, you just step back a bit.
Do you know what? The most fulfilling thing about running a business is having an idea, a kind of an ethereal picture in your head, and then you start it, and it's always difficult. Every business I've started. Every business we've got involved in has been difficult. It's hard work. It seems so slow to start. Then it starts to pick up pace. And then very quickly you realise that you've got to find the high quality people, better people than you. And if you don't, then I think most businesses kind of plateau. So I think for me, and it's a learned thing I've learned over the years, the problem is you can't hire those great people at the start because you can't afford them. So most businesses, there was lots of fairly day-to-day basic work needs to happen, and the founders going to have to do it themselves. Then there reaches a point when you can start to bring people in. And I think if I've got a talent, as well as having some sort of ability to see where things are going, it's finding really great people. And I've got a team around me that are exceptional, far better than I am. And I say that people think I'm being kind of, I'm not really, they're really not so much better than me. And that's why the business is thriving, because of them, not me.
Bless you. Well, hey, if you can admit that, that's brilliant. But let's start off with just saying, what does Green Arc do? You do lots of things, don't you?
So Green Arc's, I'll give you the formal answer. Our role in life is to ease the world's transition to clean energy. So we have a bunch of customers across the group who have been buying various oil services and oil related products from us for the past decade. And our job is to, starting with them, help them transition from setting fire to, in essence, fossil fuels, and move down the journey towards cleaner energy and help them understand where they are, what their own journey is, and then help facilitate that journey and help them de-risk it, I suppose, as we go on.
And on your website, so I'm going to just read a little bit of this. On your website, and you are the only ones that I've ever seen, so please contact me if you've got one of these, but there's a manifesto on the Green Arc website, which is greenarc.com, and it says, heat, light, transport, power. Humankind has created a few things more transformative, emotional generators of comfort, safety, connections and progress, the pillars upon which we have built modern life, the raw materials of which increasingly threaten it, coal, oil and natural gas still working their shift, getting their hands dirty and doing their bit. Now it's time for us to do ours. And that's only part of the manifesto. So if you're listening and watching this, I really suggest that you have a look at this, because that itself. That's what actually brought me to, I do quite a bit of research when I'm looking, you know, when I know that I'm going to speak to somebody, but actually that's what made you stand out, Chris. Looking at your manifesto, it's talking about, you know, life's dependent on, you know, lives are dependent on it, and so do livelihoods. And it's just so pertinent, so important. Well, what made you do that?
Well, actually, when we came up with the concept of Green Arc as a business, we took two other businesses that we already owned and amalgamated them and rebranded them as Green Arc to become our platform to pivot away from the oil industry. What became clear was, we talked about trust before we came on air. If we're going to help customers, if we're going to guide customers through this journey, most of my customers, it doesn't matter whether they're consumers or whether they're businesses, are totally and utterly befuddled by all of the noise out there about the terms of degree. Not helped, I shall say, by, you know, various authorities chopping and changing their mind.
Yeah.
And so it's quite daunting for customers. So therefore, the only way, realistically, we're going to be able to be credible in this space is if we can generate trust.
Mm.
And therefore, and this is an environment where there's a lot of greenwashing and a lot of people saying one thing and doing another. And so therefore, it became evidently clear to me I needed to have a brand, a platform that people engage with and create and generate trust. More than just a transactional, yeah, we sell stuff, we buy stuff. So I actually approached an old university friend of mine who also went to Sheffield, Polly, as did
okay.
you. And she runs, she's a very successful marketeer now, worked for Saatchi, ran her own PR business. She now runs a business that in essence creates brand platforms. Now, her and I did marketing together when we were at university, and I didn't know what she was talking about. So she sat me down and took me through the process of, if you're going to do this, you've got to go through, it's quite a big process. The output, or one of the outputs, is the manifesto. And actually what you just read out is the script for a film that we've just had produced, which is about a minute and a half long. And we agreed it needed to be, not quite Hollywood, but it needed to be really high production quality.
And powerful.
So, because it's got to trigger emotions in people, not just transactions. And if you think about the great brands, they all have an emotional resonance, and that's what we're trying to build. But to do that, you've then got to operate in a certain way. You can't go out to the world and say, we're going to do the right things, we're going to help you, and then behave in a different way. You very, very quickly found out. So for us, it's been an important part of setting out who we are internally as well as externally. That manifesto is there as Kate, who's my ex-uni colleague who wrote it for us, and her team, it's a North Star. It reminds us what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And if we find ourselves veering off the path, then it can bring us back to make sure that we stay focused on what we're trying to achieve.
It's really just that, just reading it is really, really powerful. And like I say, I think it's something that more businesses, if they're not doing it, need to do, because it's more than just a paragraph on your website, isn't it? Or a little, you know, sign up in your office saying, this is what we want to do. This is what you've done, is you've written something that means something.
It does. And it wasn't a simple process. It wasn't something we just sat around and had a few coffees and thought about. There was a lot of work went into the wording. And one of the things that the guys who built it for us and helped us kind of develop it with is, don't just take bits of it. It works as a manifesto. So my marketing team were desperate to chop it up and throw it onto Twitter. No, you can't. It has to stand, which is why the film's so important, because in effect, that is the voiceover. What you've just read is the voiceover. Mm-hmm. And the image is amazing. The music's amazing. And it just captures people's imagination. So, yeah, the film's not been released as of now. Well, we're now in October, but it's coming out, I think, in the next couple of weeks. It's worth a watch.
I will definitely watch that. So we were talking before we started recording about the size of companies that you're helping, you're easing them over to decarbonisation. So predominantly, you originally were working in kind of the oil sector, weren't you, as it were? How How did you decide to pivot, and how do you, I know you've kind of said it, but how do you pivot other companies and ease them over, like you were saying? What do you have to do that?
So what triggered us first? So as well as the oil businesses, which we have three groups, we also, my wife and I run a commercial property business. And about when we first started one of the services companies in oil, we also started doing solar installs because it seemed, this is back in 2010, 2011, it seemed sensible to me that if we're selling oil, if we then sold solar panels, this is commercials, we could reduce the amount of oil the customers needed. That seemed a good thing. And just as we're getting up to speed, we did quite a few installs. The government completely changed policy around feed-in tariffs, and it literally chopped the knees out of that industry. And I was in the room in Birmingham when the minister announced the change in the rules, and there was visual horror around the room as that entire business model collapsed. It was terrible to see thousands of businesses went bust. It was at that point I decided I wasn't going to invest my money into an industry that was so exposed to a political whim.
And
I largely kept out of it for a few years. What I did do, however, was implement it myself in my own property business. So we installed a bucket load of solar panels. We installed a biomass pellet boilers, a pair of big ones, big commercial ones. We put air source pumps in. We bought some hybrid cars. We bought some electric cars, partly to figure out what it was all about. And I've always believed that's the best way. You just go and do it yourself and figure out what the... What I didn't do was have a plan. I did it literally by just writing checks and just buying stuff. So I didn't sit and look at our start point. I didn't measure where we... Didn't measure the impact. I just literally did a load of stuff, which is a bit embarrassing. I'm supposed to be good at running businesses, and I should know that if you're going to make an investment, it should have an investment case. It should have a set of measures, set of criteria. We didn't do any of that. The consequence of not having a plan was some of the projects were really successful by luck and some were terrible. I mean, we wouldn't have known. So the solar panels actually worked a treat. And the biomass boilers were an absolute car crash. We ended up tearing them out because it was just, they were horrific to operate expense-wise and practical-wise. What it taught me was if you're a business and you're going to invest in green stuff, you should never be doing it for the wrong reasons. You shouldn't be doing it for because it looks good or I think I ought to. That's not a justification for expenditure. And any CFO or FD worth a soul will throw you out of the room if you came in with that proposition. So what you have to do, and this is our starting point as a business, is understand where you're starting from. So you need to do a piece of carbon accountancy, for want of a better term, where you understand where your start point is. Then you need to understand what your motivations are. Why are you doing this? What is the business case for these investments? And then you need a set of projects that can deliver those returns. And I became ever more of the view, probably 2014, 2015, what became clear is we built quite a considerable array of businesses, all predominantly in the oil and services and products. But if I didn't pivot, they had a shelf life. You know, by 2014, 2015, the direction of travel had become pretty clear. We knew where we were going. It was still the Paris Climate Accord at the time, but what then became net zero. And I was trying to figure out how do I take an oil bit or three oil businesses and pivot them into green, for want of a better term. And the conclusion I came to was there are things we could do around the oil distribution. So we're now one of the largest HVO suppliers in fuel, which is a fossil-free diesel alternative. We do a huge amount of work outside of the oil industry in our services business. But the business that really lent itself was what is now GreenArc, which was a fuel cards and a brokerage business for fuel, UK-wide. And that lent itself to being one that I could utterly transform into being a business, a way of taking customers on that journey. Mm-hmm. So we ended up selling the fuel distribution business to the staff. So we called an employee trust. So we created a trust, which the staff are beneficiaries of. And that's over time, they then get to keep all the profits, which is great. The services business is run by a complete separate CEO who runs that. I'm at arm's length of that. It's a fantastic business. and my time and the other guy's time they spent on Green Arc. And what we're trying to do is, if we look at when you talked about the three markets before, so I see the market for the green transition in three sides. The people spending almost all of the money today, so October 23, are corporates and public sector.
Mm.
They have the money, they have the incentives, they're being told by and large to do it, and they're doing it. That's where the vast majority of spend is. And the people that are engaged are the large consultancy houses, big players, and that's largely where it's happening. The commercial SME space, if you like, which is huge, is now starting in the last 12, 18 months to start to need to invest almost exclusively. The reason they're investing is that their large corporate supply chain are mandating it. We talked about this, but a year, 18 months ago, you could take a contract for public sector, tick a few boxes to say, we're doing green stuff. Yeah, don't worry, and that would be enough. Over the last 12, 18 months, that's changed. So what we're seeing now is you have to have a very clear defined strategy for decarbonisation if you want to play in that space.
Mm.
So consequently, a lot of our customers are now coming to us going, we need a plan. We need something that will stand up to scrutiny of a corporate or a public sector buyer. Can you help us put something together that's coherent and demonstrable? And that's what we do. Our third sector, which is the domestic homeowners, which we have a lot of because of our oil business, the amount being spent is tiny in comparison. Now, it may look like there's lots of solar panels on roofs, but there are 30 million homes and a tiny proportion of those are currently going down the green route. And that's actually slowing, if anything, at the moment due to cost of credit, cost of living generally. So the hotspot for me is in that SME space. They're the people that have got an incentive to invest into green. They need to understand it. The individual decisions aren't particularly complicated, but there's a lot of them. There's a lot of factors to take into account. And my mantra to my customers is, don't just rush in and buy stuff like I did. Don't just throw green stuff at the wall, because you'll waste an inordinate amount of investment. And that's, particularly in this marketplace and this time, is a tragedy. So be clear about what you're doing, have a plan, understand what your starting point is, and then if you want us to, we'll help you on that journey and we'll take you down the route of electric cars and solar panels and batteries and heat pumps and whatever else is needed to get you to wherever you want to be.
I love the fact that you are, we talked about the word entrepreneur, and I kind of think of myself as an entrepreneur, but you are definitely, would you call yourself a serial entrepreneur?
Yes, in this, on the basis, we talked about this before, that the higher educated you are in business, statistically, the less likely you are to start a business, because you know that the odds are unbelievably stacked against you. And as someone that did a business degree, I did my wife, and we think we've probably started 15 or 20 businesses over the last 20 years, that says something about us that what were we thinking? But I also think, back to my point before, I think the reason that, so the word entrepreneur, when I was in my early 50s, it was always a slightly kind of dubious word when I was younger.
Was it?
Before the brands of this world, before the kind of, it became a popular thing, an entrepreneur was, or a businessman was slightly spivvy. And whereas I think now it's quite a, people, I've won Entrepreneur of the Year awards at the Halifax Courier Awards and that kind of stuff, Golden Ale Business Awards, I'm very proud of that. I think the thing that differentiates entrepreneurs from what I call proper business people, I'm not very good at running businesses. It's absolutely true. I'm good at starting them. I'm good at seeing them where it could be. And I'm quite good at selling the vision to other people. And that's the key thing, is getting those people on board.
Mm.
I can't do it on my own. I do very little on my own, as my staff will tell you. But, how do we get those people in that have got the ability to execute the plans, deliver the plans? And fortunately, I have 200 people around me that are really good. And I think that's been the secret, which is why I'm a serial entrepreneur, because it gets to a certain size and then I back away.
Yeah.
Sometimes I sold them. In the past, I've sold businesses because I was no longer... You very quickly go from being the thing that turbocharges the business to the thing that becomes the anchor, the albatross.
Yeah.
And that's quite an important thing to recognize, I think, as entrepreneurs, is at which point does your shelf life end? And then either get out or get other people in. Either way, keep out of the way.
But where does it stem from? Is it from the fact that when you met your wife? I mean, or was it something? Were you one of these? So I'd say, so my nephew was started kind of washing cars for money when he was about 13. Do you know what I mean? And things like that. You know, are you kind of? And he's definitely an entrepreneur. Would you say that yours was that long ago, or was it when you met her?
I've always been fascinated by. I didn't realize it at the time, but I actually find building business is quite a creative thing.
Mm.
I'm the world's worst artist, painter, terrible. Play a bit of piano, play a little bit of music. But for me, my creativeness is in this bit. It took me a long time to realize that. So I think I've always had this desire to build stuff. Mm. And this is how I can do it. It is true, meeting my wife was pivotal because she came from a very entrepreneurial background. My parents, to be fair, ran their own businesses. So I suppose I've always been around small businesses, family-owned businesses. And then but my first job as a student at Sheffield Poly was with Hewlett-Packard down in Wokingham. And I remember walking into their offices, which at the time was brand new, in Avon Corner. And it was like walking into a spaceship. Very sadly, recently knocked down because it's now old and clunky. But in the early 90s, it was like walking into, you know, when the Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, they walk in and it's just an assort. That was like what it was like for me working into a business environment. And I'd spent most of my life kind of going through the motions a little bit, whether it was at school or in my university. I was always kind of middle of the pack. That was enough for me. I never felt the need to be the best at anything. I never wanted to be bottom either. The moment I walked into work, and I worked into a work environment, a sales environment that I knew nothing about, it was intoxicating. And from that day on, I was driven to be the best I could be. I always, as I got into a job in sales after that, and I loved the sales job because I think I'm fundamentally lazy or difficult to motivate, shall we say. And so the great thing about being in sales is that every single year, the clock gets zeroed. In fact, every single month, the clock gets zeroed and you start again. I found that really freeing, and I always wanted to be the top of the list, and I think that brought out the drive in me. So I think the worst thing, my wife will, I'm sure, will confirm this is true, I'm at my worst when I'm not busy, or there's no stress, or there's no kind of jeopardy around. I need a little bit of risk to get me going, which is why when the businesses are kind of built, I lose interest, just because I can no longer, doesn't feel scary anymore. I need to be in an area that's a little bit chaotic and a bit, you know, nobody's quite sure what's going on, which can be a nightmare to be around.
So she's obviously put up with it for a while.
So I've told this story before, but when we first got together and we kind of sat and said, right, what do we want to be in life? And we said, well, we want to buy a farmhouse in the middle of the moors, which we have, and I want to have lots of children, which we have, 3 children, and we're going to build businesses. And she said, I'm up for it. There are 2 rules. I'm like, okay, we've got rules. That's fair enough. Rule number one, you can't put the house, our family home, on the line for our businesses.
Mm.
2, you can't become an MP, which was a bit left of field. Okay. I do like politics, but I'm completely non-party political. I have no interest in party politics. I know what you like. I don't need to get a good phone. Anyway, I can tell you over the 20 years, one of those 2 I've absolutely stuck to, which is I've never become an MP. We have put the house on the line probably 8 or 10 times, because ultimately to start a business is the only security you've got. I did it with her knowledge, by the way. It wasn't just something I didn't tell her. So, but I think that's the bit that most people don't appreciate. You know, I've got friends whose businesses have failed. It's catastrophic when that happens. And it happens lots of time. Mm. I can't remember the numbers. It's something like 1 in 3 businesses fails in the first year.
Yeah.
The ones that survive, 1 in 3 of those are dead in 3. So 50% of businesses don't make 3 years.
Mm.
So if you're going to start 15, 20 businesses, the compound probability of one of those going is quite high. Somehow I've managed not to, but when it does go wrong, it is awful. And every single business we have started has gone through a dreadful patch without fail. Whether it was her children's nursery, which was very successful, but had its tough times, all of our businesses have. And I think the key thing about entrepreneurs and the ones that ultimately go on and build decent businesses is that they just stick at it. And that perseverance, that willingness just to keep going. And then all, something always seems to come up, but it's hard. And the implications of it going wrong are awful. And I think bringing it back to the green, kind of the businesses that are in this green space now, one of the things that worries me is that partly because of political shenanigans and change of parties and change of policies, there's a whole raft of brilliant young businesses out there who are totally dependent on a market they can sell to. But that market keeps shifting under them. Same thing we saw back in 2010-11 when the feed-in tariffs were chopped with no notice at all. And we see it again now with changes in policies. Let's be honest, if we end up with a different government come the early part of 2025, all those policies could change again. Yeah. And it could even change between now and then as the politicians chop and change and what have you. If you're a small green business, desperately keen to grow, but almost always running out of cash, you need something you can build against. And I think there's going to be a lot of damage done to those fledgling businesses because they don't have a market that's being managed in a way they can actually prosper. That's a great shame. And to our detriment as a country.
I totally agree with you. But how, so in that case, if you're in this kind of market, which, you know, people that I talk to, we are, you know, everybody is it about keeping on, you know, looking at things and pivoting or having, you know, multiple fingers in multiple pies? Do you think it's that?
I think, well, inevitably, there'll be winners and losers. And that is a good thing. You know, generally speaking, the market is awash with EV charging points. Okay, if you go to any of the events, you'll just see a load of them. Mm. Now, they can't all survive. There's not enough differentiation between them.
I agree.
So they've got to figure out what differentiates them from the other people selling a 7.4 kilowatt.
Their USP.
Exactly. And so for us as Green Art, that was all about the manifesto. It was all about how we position ourselves. It was all about how we operate. They've got to do the same thing. I do think that the businesses that are best able to survive the next, let's say, 5 years. So I think it's going to be 5 years before a lot of these industries kind of crystallize and start to become business as usual. The way we've decided to do it is we have underneath Green Arc, there is a fuel card business and a fuel distribution business. We still sell diesel transits as well as electric transits. And what that gives us is a constant revenue stream and a natural hedge so that it doesn't matter to me too much how fast my customers go. Mm. The ones that, as they move, I'll just sell them different things. So that's my strategy, is have fingers in pies, have something that is naturally a hedge against total exposure to green. That's not always possible, but I think that's important. And then I think that whole entrepreneurial willingness just to keep going. Mm. I think a lot of the companies that survive will be owned and managed by people who are stubborn, bloody minded, because often that's what it takes. If I look at the people that I know that have succeeded, they typically have a, I don't know how I'm going to fix this. It's just going to, I'm going to fix it somehow.
Just going to keep going.
Just keep going. And we have in our early days, my wife and I, you know, there have been times when we've had credit cards maxed out. We had literally no wiggle room at all. We were hanging on by a thread. Somehow you just keep going. Mm. And then hopefully, it doesn't always, and I say when it doesn't, it can be catastrophic for families and marriages and all that kind of stuff. But I think that's what the winners will be. Yes, the ones with the best product, but not always. The ones that understand their customers, the ones that are able to cut their cloth accordingly, the ones that don't go too soon. A lot of it is luck. That's the other thing. You know, we talked before about entrepreneurs and everything else. Anyone that runs a business that doesn't recognize that luck is a major factor for everybody, whether it's, you know, Apple or Amazon or my business or anybody else's business, luck is always a factor. Now, you can help by grabbing luck when it comes along and making the most of it, But there are brilliant businesses run by brilliant people who just got the timing wrong.
So it is about being at the right place at the right time, isn't it?
And I think it is. And I think all I'm saying is I think that it's important that we as entrepreneurs and business owners have a level of recognition and are humble enough to say that we may or may not have been successful. Luck has always played a part. And so, so I think the green businesses that will survive will be the ones that are the good products, the ones that are differentiated, the ones that potentially have secondary streams of revenue that can keep them alive. And it may not be glorious, it may not be sexy, it may not be where you want to be, but sometimes you've got to keep the wages flowing, you've got to keep the VAT bill being paid, you've got to keep the rent paid. And I think having some form of secondary income stream, particularly that's different to your core business, is key. I had a software business 2003, 2010, and it took us almost all the time the business was alive to create the software. Meanwhile, we did some fairly, what I would consider bog standard telemarketing services for other companies just to keep us alive.
Yes.
That wasn't when we were sold, everyone wanted the software, but it took us 3-4 years to build the software. And in that time, we had to have what some might consider to be a more boring income stream. Actually, it's a great business, but it wasn't what created the value. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes you've got to be able to compromise. You've got to be able to flex, bend, react. And that's difficult.
I was going to spot the things that you need to do to make your business better. Yes. As well, because so my background is kind of in business improvement, and it's really difficult in kind of, I you know, this is being honest to people listening and watching as well, you know, it's really difficult kind of trying to get people interested, because if you talk about improvement, it makes it sound like you are telling somebody that they're not doing something right, and actually it's not that. I suppose in a way it is, but majority of it is about saying, right, okay, what you're doing is great, but what you need to do is look a little bit further afield, because and you know, you need to be looking at things slightly differently, because if you don't, because I've noticed this a lot with the kind of the green sector, as it were, as you're calling it, I'm going to go with that, you know, the phrase, so decarbonisation sector, that everybody is so into pushing forwards, marketing, selling, tenders, et cetera, that actually, I've even had somebody say to me, you know, we've not got time to kind of look, we've got to look forwards. But actually, if you don't look sideways, both ways, then you might find something that bites you on the bum, you know.
I also think that if we take the manifesto, that was brought to us, or to the concepts were brought to us by external experts who knew more about that than I did.
Mm.
And I think, again, there's a need for a level of humbleness within owners that you don't know everything. And one of the downsides, particularly for smaller businesses, and this is the thing I found much harder when we were smaller, was as the owner, you tend to hear what you want to hear, because people tend to tell you what you want to hear.
Yeah.
So consequently, no one's holding you to account. Mm. Whereas if you pay somebody externally to come in, that they're coming in to tell you they're not, you don't employ them. And I think that's one of the big challenges of small business owner management, is how do you break the omnipotent power of the owner and influence. And I've struggled with this in the past. You know, I'm very positive. I can be overbearing, believe it or not. Again, my staff will confirm that, I'm sure. So actually, the people I value the very most, and I've now got a whole team of them, who basically will tell me no.
Yes, exactly.
Or actually, Chris, we've been doing this. You're not. So, and I think that's where the external support and advice comes, is somebody with a different set of eyes that isn't sitting there with the head against the coal face going, just think about this and this and this and this other stuff. And people that reject that, like, no, we're the experts in what we're doing. Well, really? Are you? Don't know.
You can't tell me, honestly. So I've worked across since I lived in Halifax, and I said to you earlier, I moved down in 95. I've worked with lots of sectors and lots of businesses, and there is no business that I've worked with that wasn't perfect. Do you know what I mean? There's always imperfections, and you're right. And I think it goes back to what you said earlier about that word trust. It's about trust internally, trusting your staff, but also trusting that somebody else externally will come in and be honest, and not just be honest, because so even you talked about pivoting. I mean, I'm kind of pivoting currently, so from sort of improvement on the training side to back to what I was doing originally, which is kind of consultancy, which has that kind of another connotation. When you say consultant, it's like, oh, give me your watch and I'll tell you what the time is, and that's not what it's about. It's more about kind of support services, but it's about companies trusting that they can bring somebody in externally to look internally and actually not be there to just grab your money, to be they'll be there to support you in the, that's what I'm trying to do. I want to support companies moving forward in the same way that you do, but it's you've got to be open enough to that, haven't you?
Yeah, but you've got to, and I also think the way that the consultants deliver it, one of the reasons that the idea of give me the watch, I'll tell you the time, is because too many consultants do that.
Yeah, I know.
So go back to my trust thing. Actually, we spent an inordinate amount of money creating the whole brand platform piece. But I knew I was working with absolute professionals that I trusted, partly helped by the fact I knew one of the two owners. But it was a big leap for us, a big leap of faith. We've spent more on that marketing concept for what's still a relatively small business compared to anything I've ever spent before across my other businesses. But I knew I needed to do it, and I knew I needed someone I trusted to help me do it. So I think the key thing is that whoever's bringing into the business has to have that trust of the owner or whoever's paying for the work. And also, the people receiving it have got to embrace it. Now, to be fair, my guys did completely, which is really important. But I think it's very difficult. We're doing consultancy in the form of carbon accounting consultancy.
Yes.
And my general line to my customers is, you can do this yourself if you wish. It's not that difficult. But you've got nobody in your organization that's qualified to do it or has done it before. How do you know if it's right? What's the point of doing it if it's going to be wrong? It will be cheaper in the upfront to do it yourself. But actually, for a relatively small cost, I can guarantee to do it properly, and you'll get a plan out at the end of it. So I think that's the thing is, I also think when people have had good experience of consultancy, they're much more willing to do it again. I think part of the problem is there are too many watch merchants out there. That does, in the same way that it's again, a parallel issue, I think, in the green industries, is that people selling a green solution because that's what they sell. Hi, I sell solar panels. You need solar panels. A guy with a hammer looks for a nail. That is the wrong way around. That's putting the cart before the horse. It should be, where are you
What
at?
do you need?
What's your need? What's your requirements? And then helping them understand what that is.
No, it's good. Like I say, I think it sounds to me like the level of trust that you're building within your, especially like you're saying about with the SMEs, because of the fact that the majority, like you said about the before we were recording, the majority of money is going into big corporates, isn't it? And so they're investing in ESG and everything. But the number of small SMEs is massive in the UK anyway, isn't it? So that's
Do you know what? There are only, I'm sure this is right, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's only 2,000 companies in the UK with more than 1,000 employees. Tiny number. Corporates are tiny in the proportion of organisations in the UK. And then you've got 6 million-ish small businesses. Now, a lot of those are single traders and so on. I'm talking about gargantuan numbers compared to corporates. It's just that the corporates are very big and they have a lot of influence, and they're also driven by different factors. So if I was a chief executive of PLC, God forbid, I've got to adhere to my investors' ESG requirements, which is why I'm doing it, because I've got to do it. Legally, I've got to do it. I've got no choice. if I'm the chief exec of a business that provides catering services into hospitals, for instance, I'm a regional player, the reason I'm doing it is my primary care trust that are contracting me are making me do it. It's a different set of requirements, but it's every bit as real. Mm. And if I don't have those things in place, I won't win any business. And I've got to do it. But I think it's only just becoming, and we're still in the early stages of adoption within the SME space.
Yeah.
And hence, for me, that's exciting because I know there's confusion. I know there's lots of people doing stuff not necessarily for the right reasons. And they might be doing the right thing, they may not. And so my big drive is to say, slow down, look at it, understand it, relate it back to your business. Stop doing stuff because you think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible reason for doing stuff. So as a consultant, that's what I'm saying to people is, look, just measure it, understand it, tie it to the strategy, then crack on and invest. And you know you do the right thing then. You're going to get the returns.
Do you think that have your SMEs started wobbling a bit more since the kind of the U-turn, recently with the government with regards to kind of the manufacturing petrol and diesel cars? Because I know you've got green art vehicles, haven't you, as well? But obviously you're involved in EV charging as one of the parts, haven't you? Have you noticed any of the SMEs starting to rethink it again and going, oh, well, we've got an extra 5 years, so maybe I won't do it quite like this way?
No, I actually see that more and more in the domestic homeowner space.
Right.
Because largely, the people that are doing it in the business environment are committed to it. So the big corporates are doing it. So that hasn't changed. I think in terms of the announcement, the petrol to diesel, so petrol to hybrid thing is largely a red herring because they didn't actually change the percentage of vehicles that the manufacturers have got to produce. So by 2030, manufacturers have got to produce 80% of their vehicles as electric anyway. So it was frankly, I think, political rhetoric more than a practical change. And the reality is the majority of manufacturers in the European market were building around the EU, which was 2035 anyway. So I think it was, more worryingly, I think it sends out a message, which is foot off the gas. Which may end up with the right thing, but it's constantly chopping and changing. So I go back to being a pragmatist. It doesn't matter to me so much what the policy is. I just need it to be fixed and then we can work around it. But whatever it is, we'll deliver. But stop chopping and changing it. And it's going to chop and change again between now and the election and probably again after the election. So I think where it changes sentiment more is in that domestic, but actually it's just a tiny market. The number of people buying electric cars privately is a tiny number that's shrinking. The number of people that are putting electric cars into businesses is a chunkier number that's growing. Yeah. And it's growing because of people needing to have coherent strategies and wanting to retain their staff and give their staff the benefits and the tax benefits. But the vast reason that people are buying electric cars is because of the tax benefit under benefit card. That's what's driving it. The people that are doing it because it's the nice thing to do, you can count on one hand. Mm. It doesn't mean they exist and they're absolutely right to do that. That's what they do. And I think that's what's driving a lot of the private car acquisition. But it's tiny. It's not even a rounding error in the bigger scheme of things. And so until that moves into the domestic space and we start seeing more carrot and stick, I don't think there'll be a huge change in that space.
So what would you like to see happen over the next kind of 5-10 years then?
I think the biggest blocker to the migration, to the transition is itself. Actually, well, there's a number. One will be we're woefully short of skills, and that's going to get more acute. Part of the problem is a lot of the skills are trade-based skills. And over the last 50-odd years I've been alive, the trades has basically been a fairly stable environment. Mm. So the apprenticeships, traditional apprenticeships where a plumber or a heating engineer would have an apprentice work with and then they could, that's fine. We need a massive increase in skills. We need a massive increase in numbers. that model no longer works. So we've got to come up with an answer for mass apprenticeships. That means corporate involvement. That means yes. big businesses putting investment into getting high levels of skills and retraining the workforce that are there and getting people much more comfortable with software. And so it's a very different mindset. So I think skills is a huge issue. The second issue, and I think the biggest one possibly, is the inability of our large institutions around energy distribution. So that's National Grid and all of the DNOs, the old electricity boards, we knew them, who manage the networks for us. They still work like public utilities. Mm-hmm. And so I know you had the GridServ chief exec on a few weeks ago. I've heard him, you know, kind of berate the fact that they've got a load of GridServ chargers sat in service stations wrapped in shrink wrap because there's not enough power to drive them, which is insane.
Yeah, just, it is, totally.
And that is going to get worse, not better. Mm. So now the only thing that's going to change that is political will. Yeah. So everything comes back to ultimately the willingness of whichever political party is in power at any one given time, being willing to give an absolute clear steer to everybody involved that this is the direction we're going in. And at the moment, we've not got that. I'm not convinced necessarily, by the way, assuming there's a change in government, which seems to be likely based on the polls, coming into part 2025, I don't know how more willing they're going to be to tackle some of these enormous issues. They're long-term. And unfortunately, the systems that we work in are not long-term mindsets. And energy is just one example of a lack of long-term planning and thinking. We end up with short-termism. Well, that I think will hold us back. And I think we're going to see more and more frustrations as people, particularly start getting onto mass domestic take-up, people suddenly finding they can't have an electric charger at home because the grid around their housing estate is already maxed out.
Yes.
Now, that will happen. You know, unless there's a massive shift in mindset and in the infrastructure, that's going to become a problem. We're already seeing it at the high end. That's going to get worse as it grows. And that's a problem for me. So it will all come down to political will. We need clarity. We need long-term planning that we can all work to and invest in. We don't need knee-jerk. I don't actually care what the policy is. As I said to you before, I am not an evangelist for green. I can't, because then I'm not. That will break some of the trust. I'm there to help my customers on their journey. Really help me if I could see where the roadmap was going to be and not have, you know, political chopping and changing, which then makes it very, very difficult for all of us to figure out stuff.
Yeah, I was listening to, I don't know, another podcast, Diary of a CEO, and it was, they were talking about short-termism on there and kind of how it was actually creating massive issues. But I would never say, I've never ever said I've been a political person in my life, but actually some of the things that have happened over the last few months and few years have kind of bothered me a lot, especially living in a house where I'm married to a professor of climate science. Do you know what I mean? It makes me kind of That's a whole nother conversation for us, you know.
Take the party politics out of it. The reality is we have the same problem with, and it's happened over multiple generations that I've been looking at how politics works. There's just a short window that any politician's got to implement bad news to create upside. Mm. That how can you get social care, health service, education, military security, power, because they all involve long-term investments that you as that politician who signs the check won't get the benefit for. Worse, your opposition might get the benefit for. Mm. Now, we all know this is true, but so that's what worries me, is how do we, with the systems we've got in place now, make investments in long-term networks, whether it be nuclear power, whether it be offshore wind, inshore wind, solar, whatever it's going to be, we're going to have to make those investments as a nation. Because otherwise, we cannot decarbonise the grid. So the current policy of the government is that we'll decarbonise the grid by 2035. Got to tell you, from what all I read, that looks a really big challenge. Really big challenge. Because we're not making the decisions, we haven't made the decisions in the last decade to support that shift. I think the current Labour policy is to pull that forward to 2030. I can see no way, based on everything I see, that that is in any way credible. I think they have to run back on it, because that's where we're now, end of 2023. So that's 6 years away. Well, if you think about what needs to be done to remove the 40-odd percent of energy that's created by gas, which is what it means, there's just not time. These things just take too long to build. And we're hitting grid limited, all that kind of stuff. So I think that's the biggest single challenge we have as a nation. And it can't be any different. I'm not as au fait with other countries, but you know, I think it's a perpetual problem we've got, which is that's going to hold us back. That's going to slow us down and frustrate people that want to make that move.
From what I understand, because I've also interviewed Graham Cooper, who used to work for National Grid, and he's now over in the States. And from what I understand, the States' grid connection is probably on. It's in a more difficult situation than we are in the UK.
So in the last 2 months, I've been to South Korea and I've been to America and Canada, and particularly America and Canada are, if not 5-10 years behind in general sentiment. You know, it was different in California, but I was in the Northeast. Mm. You walk into, you sit in any town, and all you see is thousands of F-150 pickup trucks, V8s. Mm. And you realize how far we've come in terms of our change of attitude towards electric cars and greener technology. They are a long, long way behind. So I suspect, if it's perfectly possible, we end up with a Republican in the White House in early 25, which is the next one's June, that could slow down even further. So, yeah. They're the sort of macroeconomic things that will affect us. It's going to affect sentiment. It's going to affect the ability of the global network to be able to make these changes. It's I've never felt so insecure about that level of stuff. It's never really mattered. For most of the time I've been working, kind of geopolitical stuff has largely not been that much of a factor. Mm. Now it is. Mm. Now, almost all of the technology that we're implementing for the green transition is out of China. If for some reason that's broken, if for some reason China stops shipping us solar panels, electric cars, that's it. Everything grinds to a halt. Literally grinds to a halt. And we saw this during COVID. You know, we couldn't ship an electric car for the best part of a year.
Yeah.
Why? Because they weren't being made, because the components weren't being made. We've had impact from the Ukraine war. I don't doubt there'll be impact at some point from the issues in Israel and in Gaza. So all of that's bubbling away. It's affecting oil prices, it's affecting confidence, sentiment, inflation, all these things. Mm. And that they're all, you know, macro things that we as business people can do nothing about other than be aware of it and just keep an eye out
on it. Yeah.
How that affects us.
Yeah, exactly. So just to finish off then, if people are interested in who would you like to speak to about what you're providing at GreenArc? Who are the companies that you would ideally like to speak to, and where would they be?
So anywhere in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I think there are two main strategic drivers that I see, because it's true of my own business. The two reasons that I see people wanting to invest significant sums into this journey are people that need to do it because to drive business. So they've mm-hmm. got customers in supply chains where they're being told either now or very soon, you're going to have a credible green transition plan that's measurable and provable and not just tick box, tick box, tick box. So businesses that have got that need, I can help them with that, or my team can. Or people that are looking to, and then the other area where we're investing heavily is in bringing electric cars because of the tax benefits mm-hmm. into businesses that probably don't have any company cars right now, but have got a bunch of relatively well-paid, high taxpayers. So we're doing a lot of work with lawyers and accountants and architects and, you know, that kind of stuff, where actually having an electric car is as close to a financial no-brainer. The reason it's important for the business as opposed to the individual is it's a way to attract talent. That's why we do it. Why do I run a scheme? I've got 35 electric cars in the car park outside because it's a way of me attracting the brightest talent that I can get my hands on.
Yeah.
And it's only part of a package, but it's you know, we've got people here that have got, you know, a brand new, so a lot of the Chinese cars that are coming in are much, much better priced. There's one called a Funky Cat. Coolest yeah. thing I've seen.
Fiora.
Yeah, but they're absolutely, price point wise, they're applicable to loads more people than, I still don't think you can justify one privately because without the tax breaks, they're hard to justify. But with the tax breaks, they're amazing. So people that are looking for support and help to provide that sort of benefit to their staff, or someone that wants to understand their journey. I mean, fundamentally, our job is to go into a business, sit them down, take them through a process of saying, where are you now? Help them understand their journey, and then come up with a bunch of projects that can move them down that line. Mm-hmm. And if they want to work with us, that's great. And if they don't, that's their choice. And this is a long-term thing. This is, you know, very few businesses will come to us and reach the end of their journey in less than probably 4 or 5 years. It's taking that long for a lot of these technologies to play out. It's all about where should they be investing their money and why and what the returns are.
Mm.
But it's very much a business-driven set of decisions, not a idealistic investment, because I don't think that stacks up. People won't do that. People will just pay lip service to it.
Exactly. Tick box exercise. We don't want that, do we?
Yeah, exactly.
So where's the best place if people are looking to find you? Where's the best place? Is it through the website?
Go to greenart.com. In the next week or so or 2 weeks, the manifesto film will be there in all its glory when it's been finally signed off and released. And so, yeah, that'll be the best place. And all the contact details are there. Yeah, just click and link the team, phone the team, let us know what you want, and we'll be, you know, one of the things that I'm determined is this is a business that will reach out via marketing and messaging. I'm already seeing, you know, external telesales hitting solar panels, for instance. It's the complete wrong way about it. It is all about horse before the cart. That's not the model we're trying to do. We're trying to basically go out there with a set of messages, doing things like this, explaining what we do, and ask people to come to us, and then we'll talk to you. So, you know, that's the best way of getting hold of us.
Brilliant. Okay. So I'll also share any of your social media links and things like that, if that's all right.
That's brilliant.
Well, listen, it's been really interesting talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. No, you weren't talking. No, it was good. It was good. No, thank you ever so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And like I say, I'll share all your links and everything when the podcast goes out live. So thank you, Chris. And to everybody else, I'm going to say I shall see you next time. Goodbye. Thanks for listening to Electric Evolution with Liz Allen. If you want to find out more about Full Circle Continuous Improvement, please visit us at www.fullcircleci.co.uk. Don't forget to keep listening for more episodes coming up really soon.